The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
And I'm one of the regular co-hosts, Greg Fries and Rob Terrio. And then our third co-host is Bill Toon. He's back in Kansas, maybe watching us on the live stream. If you are, hi, Bill. We miss you. We'd love to meet you in person someday. Can you believe it, Rob, the number of hours we've spent with Bill without ever actually meeting him?
I know. Strange. It'll be like a blind date.
You got to get in nice and close.
Okay.
Yep.
Just as well no one heard that comment then.
I'm hopeful that when we do meet him, we actually like him. Good. And then live audience, we've got Jeff Dean and Chief Mike Touchstone joining us for a live panel for a bit this evening. So both of you guys, welcome.
Thank you.
Oh, good work. I'll be asking for all of your audio to be synchronized from here on out. So.
Okay.
And I'd like to hear multiple word responses.
We're the Blue Man Group.
We're the Blue Man Group.
And there's a synchronized swimming portion to the show as well, if you wouldn't mind standing on stage. And
yeah, flutter kicks for sure.
That would be great.
So, Jeff, have you been to any sessions yet today?
No, I walked in about 20 minutes before I talked to you, and I'm trying to catch up.
Perfect timing.
Yes.
And Mike presented, which we'll be talking about in a bit, but did you attend any sessions?
I did attend the opening session.
Okay, good. How was that?
It was good.
Yeah?
It was good. I mean, it pointed out some of the things that we really need to be paying attention to.
What, for example?
Professional behavior, which is one of my passions. The fact that we really need to stop keying on response times and really look towards outcomes,
right?
Which is critical. We have to change the way we think about what we do, and that's what he was talking about this morning.
Outstanding. How are we doing back there? It's always logistics. Even when we do the show, we regularly broadcast Wednesday nights, record Wednesday nights. Rob in Canada, me in Wisconsin, Bill in Kansas, and invariably we have some sort of technical thing that delays our start. Sometimes it's like Greg needs a glass of water. Other times it's Bill's got to reboot his computer, or Rob has to
go to the bathroom,
or your daughter needs you to launch some sort of iPad app for her.
I can hear you.
Okay. Oh, okay. We got a thumbs up from the crowd. Are we ready to go? Hey, Chris, are we recording? Okay, we're going to go live. We're going to count this down and start our official podcast on 3, 2, 1. Welcome to the EMS Educast podcast, the one and only podcast by and for EMS educators. We're recording this session live at the EMS Today show in Baltimore, Maryland. We're very excited to be here. We've got a really raucous live audience that's loving every minute of this. I'm one of your regular co-hosts, Greg Fries, and for the first time, we've done many of these conference shows, well, two previous, but for the first time, I'm joined by Rob Terrio. Rob, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here. It's strange podcasting and not wearing my pajamas.
Well, I had that same thought of, it is strange to see you not in your pajamas. Wait, we usually record on Wednesday nights at the end of the workday, and Rob even on Eastern time, much later than us. And I've got a couple of guests to introduce in just a moment, but first, to humor me with one exciting announcement. Last night, the EMS Educast was recognized with an EMS 10 Innovation Award sponsored by GEMS and Physio Control. And yes, it's very exciting recognition of the work we've done to connect with EMS educators.
And more specifically, Greg Fries was recognized. You're really the hero in this.
Well,
that event. So congratulations.
Thank you. I think it would
be a
push to call me a hero, but maybe an organizer. And really, this has been just a terrific hobby for me to to work on these shows. We're up over 90 episodes. We've got, by now, I'm sure when we get the next set of download statistics, we'll have more than 100,000 downloads of all past episodes, which is pretty amazing, and the connections that we've formed with educators all over the world. So look for more information about that EMS 10 award at the GEMS.com website. They'll be publishing more, and there'll also be a May issue of the magazine. We'll have an inset there. And then I should also say that we appreciate we're broadcasting from the Zoll Podcasting Studio, which is part of the ProMed Network. So, Zoll, thank you for hosting and sponsoring these episodes today.
And check out the Zoll EPCR on iPad. It's spectacular.
Really? Are you using it, or you just got a demo of it?
I'm not using it. I'm using the EPCR on Toughbook, which is okay. The iPad, just the iPad, is a wonderful device. It's easier to keyboard, in my humble opinion, and just a beautiful device. So congrats to Zoll.
Make sure you guys, when you come in real close to the microphone when it's your turn to talk. So I'm going to start at the far end. We've got Chief Mike Touchstone from the Philadelphia Fire Department. Mike, welcome.
And thank you for having me.
And I can call you Mike, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
And Mike and I have connected at NAMSE conferences for years, National Association of EMS Educators, and I've many times wanted him on the show, so I'm thrilled to finally have him. And then sitting next to Mike, paramedic Jeff Dean. Jeff.
Nice to meet you. Thanks.
And where did you arrive from today?
I live in Salisbury, Maryland, work in Berlin, Maryland, so it's about a two-hour drive.
Okay. Well, nice and close to home for you to be here. And we're going to go to Mike first just because you've got limited time, but you were a presenter today, I believe, in the leadership track?
Yes.
And just give us a brief overview of the topic. And
what I spoke about today was a difficult topic to address called changing employee behavior. It's something that we struggle with.
And changing it for the better, obviously.
Well, that's the goal. We would like to have performance improvement, although sometimes you have to initiate discipline, which might lead to somebody no longer saying, excuse me, what's your chief complaint, to saying, excuse me, but would you like fries with that?
And, you know, one of the things, I think this is both applicable for classroom educators, but also a training officer or a preceptor. You laid out that there's both a structure and a process, and what, at least the message I took, is sometimes we get in trouble because we choose to do one or the other and not both.
Well, the structure gives you a way of thinking about the components of the process and how they fit together, and then the process tells you how to apply the structure. So frequently we'll get something like a curriculum that tells you what to teach, but you don't get input on how to teach.
Right.
Now, a lot of times, if you're a skilled educator, you already know how to teach, and you can take the information and push it forward. But in things, particularly in EMS, about leadership and management, they are not currently part of the curriculum. So we have to push forward both the what and the how. So I tried to address both.
Right. And I thought you did well. One of the things I was wondering about is, a lot of the examples and then the questions from the audience were individual, focused on, like, how would you raise up an individual? But sometimes I feel like a culture in an organization, you know, even if you try to raise up, you're one person, but the whole rest of the culture is trying to push that person down as you're trying to raise them up.
That's one of the conundrums.
Yeah.
I was speaking with guy I recently met who's a leadership guru kind of guy, and one of the things he suggested is part of the process is having courage to be the individual, to risk being the nail that sticks up. And one of the things that happens is your peers will see what's happening, and if we do a good job of reward and recognition as part of the process,
right,
we may see changes in culture over time. But it takes the courage to be that one person, then the second person, then the third person. Management theory, and if you read some of the management books, will suggest that if you work hard, you can change the culture of an organization. So part of what we have to do is be clear about what we expect. And when you're talking about a process that was for individuals, well, that same process is applicable for an entire organization easily from the perspective of quality improvement assessments.
Yeah.
So the process is scalable. It can be personal that you implement for yourself or for a subordinate or with a peer or for an organization at the clinical level or even the entire organizational culture. So as a paramedic in a fire department, I've been struggling with cultural issues for a long time. But you still have to keep forging ahead.
Keep going. Robert, Jeff, feel free to jump in here too.
When you talk about individuals in the department who are struggling, perhaps from a patient care perspective or from a cultural perspective, how is that usually identified to you? Is that through complaints? Is that through things that you notice through your quality assurance process? So how are you initially made aware of those issues?
Well, most of the time I'm made aware of them in a training setting, in tests, written tests to determine knowledge competency, or in scenario-driven assessments for skill and knowledge. And it will come from CQI, it will come from the medical director, it will come from our special investigations officer, and then it will, ideally, it comes from eyes on in field.
Because that's one of the things, actually, I was wondering about as you spoke today, and you actually showed a video clip from a reality television show about EMS, and I was thinking, you know, what if that guy just had a bad day? Like, that was his bad call? Like, the, you know, how do you avoid putting the hammer down on somebody that's just had a bad day or they made a slip-up and...
Well, if you saw the video, and
well,
you did,
right, yeah,
you would know that it was more than just a bad day,
yeah,
because there was a lot of people on the scene. To just set the stage, it was a call where a first responder engine company had been treating a man complaining of chest pains,
right,
and then the medic showed up, and then things progressed in a way that might have been less than optimal. So the key, though, is to have a dialogue with the individual to find out what exactly is going on.
Right.
Well, he might tell you that, you know, his kid died or something that really messed him up for today, but it'll be a one event. If it's a pattern event, and if you see and observe and evaluate over time repetitive behavior, and this is all built, by the way, on a foundation that they have to clearly, all your employees, all your subordinates, all your peers have to really understand the expected behaviors across the board, both knowledge, skill, and attitude.
Right.
So if they know what they're supposed to do, and we as leaders and managers and educators clearly communicate the outcome that we expect, and they're not meeting it, now you have to find out why, which in this process is a diagnostic conversation.
Because, yeah, you know, I was just thinking about that observer bias. Like, if I was Jeff's supervisor and he never sees me, and then one day I just show up on a call, like, oh, here I am, Jeff. Go ahead. Do your paramedic thing. You know, I can imagine that might rattle you a little bit.
Yeah, that happens actually in the field, and it does rattle us a little bit, yeah.
But if it happens often enough, though, you get used to it. And
that's the key, you see. If your eyes on a regular basis, sometimes you'll get different kinds of bias. Like, they'll do everything right because you're there.
Right.
So if they get comfortable, they'll start going back to their bad habits, or maybe not. But eyes on will let you know. And then when you observe something that is not meeting your expected behaviors that you talked about before, then you have a conversation to find out what's going on.
Yeah, I used to do a lot of vehicle driver instruction, and I'd be in the passenger seat. And everyone would start out, you know, 10 and 2, real good posture, 2 miles, and all that was out the window, and they were back to whatever they usually do. Yep, exactly.
One hand on the top.
Yep.
So, Mike, in your experience, are at the root of most of the issues involving individuals, is it attitude that permeates into or translates into poor patient care, or do you see people with distinctly behavioral issues versus others with distinctly competency issues in terms of skill?
Well, what I would say is each individual case is individual unto itself. What I can tell you from the statistics of the Philadelphia Fire Department is we do in the neighborhood of 300,000 emergency medical responses annually. And out of those responses, we have about 200 plus or minus 15 maybe annual complaints. So the public is satisfied with the service. But the majority of the complaints are based on attitude. So the public really doesn't know much about medicine except what they've seen on Grey's Anatomy or House, and that's not too realistic. So you have to, you as the supervisor, or you yourself have to assess what it is that you're doing. Are you meeting those expectations? Why haven't you if you haven't? And this, by the way, this process isn't always for people that are problems. It can be somebody who's looking to do personal professional development, can follow this same cycle, set the baseline expected behaviors, assess for performance gaps, evaluate and diagnose for causes of the gaps, make a performance improvement plan, and then reevaluate. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes the reevaluation is going to lead to better improvement. Sometimes it's going to lead to you didn't meet the goals and there's going to be consequences.
Right. Now, what you're saying, what you're describing about the types of complaints you receive most commonly is common in all services in EMS, North America, Europe wide, I'm sure. And we know as educators that the most challenging thing to teach, or the most challenging area in which to teach, is the affective domain, is getting people to change their, really it's not their behavior, it's their attitudes, and change in attitudes results in change of behavior. So being the challenge that is, do you have any pearls of wisdom, any secrets to part on us on how you would address those? Because what you describe sounds like a kind of a checklist, but how do you get to the root of the issues and address those?
You can't really change somebody's attitude per se, because you really don't know what the attitude is. Only thing you can measure and observe is how they behave. Now, it may be based on facial expression. It may be based on other nonverbal communication, like body language, stance, and posture. Those are things you can observe. You can also observe things like tone of voice, pace of voice, choice of words, way you handle a patient. All of these things reflect on the way you value and your set of values and your attitude towards patient care. So can you really know what somebody's values are? Can you really measure them? It's kind of tough. What can you see is how they behave, and that you can measure. There's also some thinking that if you change the way people behave, you will in turn change the way people think, and you may be able to then change their values and their attitudes. It even goes to the point where changing the way you think can change the structure of your brain. Neuroplasticity is a relatively new science. So the difficulty that we put on ourselves about the affective domain is thinking about values rather than thinking about behaviors. And all of the difficulty stems on how do you measure the behavior. So we have to be able to articulate. We expect you, for instance, to show up to work on time, fit for duty, right? Wearing a clean uniform, et cetera. Those are affective domain. They reflect your attitude about work. I can't tell you you think work and fill in the blank as a descriptor, but I can say you showed up late 3 times, so you're fired.
Right. And you can, I don't envy your position, because you can discipline someone for showing up late for work, not wearing a uniform properly, but you can't necessarily change the way they feel about things by doing that. So now, I think about when we encounter patients who are hostile towards us, or they're refusing to go to hospital, and clearly they need to go to the hospital, and they're rude to you. There's almost always something lurking in the background that's keeping them from either wanting to go to the hospital or making them hostile towards you. And from a patient care perspective, we take kind of a professional, kind, compassionate approach, and usually that whatever it is that's driving that hostility reveals itself and they become a little more compliant. When you're dealing with individuals for whom they've received complaint number 2, complaint number 3, do you have any kind of counseling services or any ability to connect on them to determine what the deeper root of the problems are?
Well, the first piece of the puzzle is talking to the individual and listening to what they have to say. When you point out that whatever you did, whatever specific behavior you demonstrated doesn't match with the expected behaviors that led to a complaint, we have to go into a diagnostic mode in a conversation. Just like you do therapeutic dialogue with a patient, you kind of treat this individual as though they were a patient. Is there a problem? So could it be a drug problem? Could it be a personal issue? Could it be financial? Could it be, I don't like this job anymore?
Or the partner they're working with.
Well, and that's a really, really critical part of everything we do in EMS. Right. If you have a bad partner, you got a bad day. You know, so what can we do? We have to diagnose it. So then maybe we're going to do education because they don't know. Or we might do training because they don't know how. Or we might do training and education to tell them about values, tell them about expected professional behaviors, and then practice it in the sort of role play arena so that you're doing both education and training to address values. And you said you can't change values and beliefs, but I think you can. I think with consistent messages and peer pressure and a good process, that if you can change behavior, you can change the way people and their value sets. Because part of education is to move people to where they naturalize values. Our fire department, the Philadelphia Fire Department, we have our organizational values hanging in our auditorium. So we continually reinforce what we think is important. Does it change behavior? I don't know. I mean, but it can.
Hey, Jeff, before Mike needs to leave, do you have a question or anything you want to add to the conversation on this aspect?
I do have some thoughts that fall in line. They're related to language barrier and so on. But one of the things we've been working on with our project, which I'll introduce in a second, has been that the cultural attitude regarding the perceived responsibility for EMS jurisdictions when caring for patients who don't speak English. And so I've been listening closely to that, how to change cultural attitudes. I've heard other speakers speak on the same topic. It is a large, complex.
It sure is. More than we can get done in the time we have available. Mike, do you have a closing thought?
Well, one of the things I would think is most important is for us to add to our curricula components that teach professional behaviors, mm-hmm. that clearly lay out, these are what we expect of you, this is what the public expects of you, this is what your peers expect of you, and this is what the job expects of you. Add that to our education.
Right.
Teach them what values are. Teach them what ethics means. Teach them what altruism is. How do you measure compassion? There's a whole series of articles that I wrote for EMS Magazine last year, mm-hmm. that addresses these professional behaviors. And I would urge those of you that are educators, managers, leaders, to do some personal research to find out what you can do, because there are things you can do. Right. And it doesn't just work in education or management. It's all the same stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think.
Well, great. And we'll try to get a link to some of those articles in the show notes, and I would really encourage listeners to check those out because it's a real nice series, and I think you've done a really good job with those articles is drawing in from other professions and other academic areas of what are the lessons we can learn about management, leadership, discipline, and those sort of things. Finally, if a listener wants to connect with you, can they find you online or send you an email or something like that?
Well, you can find me on Facebook.
All right.
And actually, I'll give you my home email address as well. It's m-touch@comcast.net.
Okay. So listeners, if you want to connect with Chief Michael Touchstone, Philadelphia Fire Department, please do, and also a frequent conference speaker, and encourage you to check out one of his shows. Thanks again, Mike, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Greg. Hope to see you again in this venue once more.
All right, cool. So we're going to have a transition that somebody else is going to come into that spot.
If I can help you with stuff, give me a shot.
And we'll carry on here. So, Jeff, while we're making that transition, first of all, introduce EMS. I'm going to, you do it.
EMS Spaniel.
EMS Spaniel.
May I hold the book up?
Yeah, you
all
bet.
Right. So Angel Berba is one of my sponsors. I've never met her before.
Well, we're here to bring people together.
And you have.
Fascinating. Like chocolate and peanut butter.
This types of things keep happening to me this year. The long and short of this situation is I'm a paramedic from Maryland, Berlin, Maryland, and I don't speak Spanish very well. And so I had purchased a number of other products to try and bridge that language barrier over the years. A man named Miguel Castañares from he's an Argentine-born American citizen, joined the Berlin Fire Company as a volunteer. And I asked him immediately, the funny story of it is that one of the young volunteers in the fire company came up to me one day all stricken and said, we have an illegal alien Mexican who doesn't speak any English who has joined the fire department. I was like, great. I want to learn Spanish. So I went up to him and I said, hello, my name is Jeff. And he's like, oh, hey, Jeff, how are you? You know, he's an American citizen. I mean, he's lived here and college educated, and he's from Argentina. So I asked him to teach me how to speak Spanish. After about a month of that, we realized that there was no chance of me learning enough Spanish to treat life and death emergencies. Yeah. The level of accuracy is just too high, and the time constraints are too limited in EMS. So what we ended up doing is spending the next year putting together a concise but complete ALS assessment in English, okay. And then he made the most efficient, easiest to pronounce Spanish translation that he could find.
Okay.
And so the way we did that, basically, he would write down four or five different ways to translate something and then let me stammer my way through them. The one that I butchered the least, he chose to include in the book. So our continuing education portion of this has been to isolate the elements of Spanish that we feel that are necessary for our process, which is simply the ability to sound Spanish when reading, right. The ability to pronounce and learn phonemics. So it's been a fascinating year for us since the books came out. We've been in business for 3 years now, but the books actually came out a year ago. They're all over the country now, out in L.A. and Texas, and we're getting really good feedback.
Terrific.
Yeah.
So let me bring in Angel Berba, longtime friend of the Edgecast, and was a guest co-host once after Namsie, I believe, and many times guest. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And make sure you're real nice close right into the microphone.
How's
when
this?
You talk. Wonderful. And just real
nice
briefly.
Thank you. Thanks.
Maybe just briefly tell the listeners that are new to the show what it is that you do, and then maybe talk about how it was that you connected with Jeff and Miguel.
I am the program director of a community college paramedic program here in Columbia, Maryland. And spent some time in the military as a medic and have gone to college, got my master's degree now in EMS education, and actually also the immediate past president of the National Association of EMS Educators. But I had seen a picture of Jeff and Miguel. Miguel, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Jeff and Miguel in our state EMS newsletter, talking about this really cool product that was out there, and it gave the contact information for the guys. And I just remember I read the story and I thought, this is really intriguing. And then I saw that they were local guys, and I thought, wow, this is really cool, and I'd like to contact them and find out what they're doing with this product and what are they intending to do with it, and have they done anything, have they developed any kind of educational pieces or anything like that. And placed a phone call, and I guess it was an email, but about 5 seconds later I have a phone call. And we talked for about an hour or so that day and just kind of talked strategies at instructional design and things like that, and it's just kind of gone from there.
Yeah. So go ahead, Rob.
Yeah. So, Jeff, give us a synopsis of the book. Is it my perception of translation books is a series of simple phrases that we can use as EMS providers to ascertain chief complaint, history presenting illness.
We worked on some premises when we started, and when we realized we had an idea, first of all, we clammed up, and then we decided to get very formal about it. So we wrote down our premises that we were working on, and one of those was that the provider would speak no Spanish, have no experience with Spanish, that the patient would speak no English, and that the provider would never have picked up our book before using it for the first time in a life and death emergency. So what that required of us was that our phrases would be easy to pronounce and easy to understand when mispronounced by the provider who has no Spanish-speaking experience. We debated all sorts of finer points, like do we write down the Spanish translations in phonetics, or do we write them out in Spanish? do we use formal tenses or informal tenses, all of these linguistics questions. What we ended up doing is writing them down in true Spanish, informal style. And the reason we did that is because we wanted the book to be able to solve as many problems in as many ways as possible. So we wanted the patient to be able to read the words. So the provider can literally hold the book up in front of the patient's face and point at a phrase if they're just overwhelmed and intimidated by the process. The informal structure of the sentences in Spanish language, in some cultures, the formal tenses that you would use with people who are outrank you, I guess, can what I consider inflame modesty. You know, so okay. If someone's addressing you formally, you may not be willing to tell them, you know, frankly, about your bowel movements or your gastric health or something. So we decided to go with an informal tense so that we would immediately say we're on the same level. Even if outside of this situation we're on different levels socially, we are here together in this. So when you open the book for the first time, the first thing you see is an airway breathing circulation assessment. We don't care who you are or how you came to be this way. You're dying and we're going to fix it. When you flip to the second page, it basically starts with a very brief patient contact. I am a paramedic. Everything is – we even toyed around with the idea of creating a pigeon, if you know what I mean by a pigeon, no. Which is an abbreviated way of speaking another language.
Okay.
We didn't do that ultimately, but it, I guess, reveals the level of thinking we were doing on that. Right. Let's just solve the problem. It doesn't matter how clean it sounds. It doesn't matter how perfect or textbook it sounds. We need to solve this crisis. So we basically address the highest priorities of the ALS provider. BLS providers can use it as well, but we wanted it to be all-inclusive at an ALS level. And broke it up into treatment groupings. We have one of the topics that's near and dear to my heart is refusal of care forms, bilingual refusal of care forms. Mass casualty incident, both Start and Jump Start, sponsored by the owners of those products, and some other pronunciation guides and Con Ed type stuff.
So give me a scenario. I'm Spanish speaking. I'm having chest pain. I'm pale. I'm cool. I'm diaphoretic. You open the book.
Sure.
Maybe you should hand the book to me.
Oh, there you go.
Okay. There you go.
I don't speak Spanish. Okay. I've never touched this book before.
I won't be able to answer you in Spanish. Can we do this in French?
How about if I answer you in Spanish?
Okay.
Okay.
Señor.
Si.
I'm sorry. No te mueves.
Okay, I'm in a car accident.
Okay.
You're telling me. So what you just told me is don't move.
Don't move.
Okay.
All right.
Are we in an immediately life-threatening situation?
I'm not sure. I thought he had chest pain.
Okay,
I'm
so
sorry.
Turn to the patient contact page, which is the next page.
Patient contact page.
Yes, it's the very next page. Okay. Yeah. Now start right there on the first line.
Hola.
Hola.
Soy paramédico.
Okay.
I think you said I'm a paramedic.
Yes.
That part I got.
Hablo inglés.
Me?
Yeah.
No.
Hablo
inglés. No inglés.
No soy policía.
Okay. Gracias. He said, I am not police.
Estamos aquí para ayudarte.
You are here to help me. Thank you.
Good. Tengo que examinarte.
You have to examine me. Okay. I understand that.
Greg, that's impressive.
¿Dónde te duele lo?
Where do I hurt? ¿Dónde te duele?
Yeah.
That's fine. Close enough.
Minutos?
Minutos?
Minutos.
Okay. And one of the things we're getting at there is, I believe the question prior to that was, how long have you been this way?
Right.
Okay, here's my concern.
Yes.
He says, where do you hurt?
Right.
You answer in a sentence.
Right.
Greg looks at you blankly. I have no idea what you just said.
One of the sentences in there is, please respond yes or no.
Okay.
Only. The idea is that you will read each line in order as you find them. So we've built a conversation almost like a dialogue in a novel,
and
you don't have to search.
There's branching points.
Yeah.
And you were saying you could show them the book?
You can.
Where you're asking the question?
Yeah. Just because they don't speak English doesn't mean they don't read their own language.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
Respondo si or no.
Right.
I meant for your benefit, the person asking, rather than their benefit.
Sure. Right. I know.
It's not going to be pretty. We're very clear on
that. I've capably demonstrated.
Right. The ugly American.
That's why I'm doing podcasting, because it's not pretty.
But the alternative of trying to add, you know, mime it or something is not
right.
Good.
Which touches on what I was getting at with Chief, which is that in the process of coming out and talking to people about this book and the process, what we get some feedback is basically, this is not my problem. You know?
Right. Yeah. So let's step out from the bigger into that bigger picture and that.
we're getting a little bit of pushback from EMS jurisdictional leaders, actually, who are saying that's great, but this is not ultimately our it's not in our scope. It's not in our responsibility to treat everybody who doesn't speak English. A little bit of me agrees with that. You know, I'd say, is it really realistic for us to expect full scope of practice for every language in the United States or every language in the world? It's a tall order.
Yeah.
And one of the things I've been asking the EMS community through blogs and forums and through this, you know, any conversation I can have, is for people to think about scope of practice as it relates to the limitations inherent in the language barrier. And if we should begin considering language barrier in and of itself, unbridged language barrier in and of itself, a contraindication to certain things, for instance, medication administration. Obviously, to give medicines, you have to explore allergies, contraindications, adverse reactions, and so on. If you know going into that assessment that you can't do that, should we be saying maybe we don't give medicines in those situations?
Although I don't think you can do that carte blanche, to use a French expression. You know, because there's some life-threatening situations where you know, the clinical picture says clearly this patient's in anaphylactic shock, and epinephrine's clearly indicated, and are there any contraindications really for epinephrine?
Right.
That's
but you know what?
Go ahead, and then we've got to get Angel.
I just want to touch on one other thing you said, because it's interesting, you know, that some services may have the perception that this is not within our scope to do this. But I look at another language in the same way I look at a physical disability or a mental disability. Our role as, you know, patient advocates is to learn as much as we can about all sorts of barriers, not just language barriers, but physical barriers, mental health barriers, and that makes us better care providers. So I really see no conflict whatsoever there.
The conflict I have internally is a liability issue. And so if what you're saying is, okay, we're going to treat every Korean speaker, Vietnamese speaker, everybody, to the full scope of practice. One thing you're either saying is, okay, paramedics, give these people full care, or don't give them full care because you can't understand them. And the paramedic's stuck in the middle and can't win that one.
Right.
Either you fall short on your care, or you try to give them too much care and give them a medicine that hurts them or does, you know, misdiagnose them or something. So it is an internal struggle on my part.
But, you know, we do that now. I look at that as, you know, we look at every intervention in terms of risk-benefit ratio and based on the information that we can obtain. So, for example, if we're dealing with someone with Alzheimer's who doesn't comprehend or doesn't know whether they have allergies or not, we look at what we intend to do in terms of risk-benefit ratio, and does that medication, we know that medication is indicated. And we know there are really no contraindications, you know, using the previous example. So again, I see. It would be really unsettling to see any service take the approach of it's either all or nothing.
No. Yeah. And what I'm getting at is basically, I'm trying just to conclude my thought, is to get the EMS community thinking of language barrier as an issue in and of itself,
right?
And to say, at what point do we treat language barrier as an issue? An actual formal issue within protocol, within guidelines, right. And to say, and I include within language barrier, Alzheimer's, stroke patients, the deaf, children, people who can't entirely communicate their history to you. At what point do you say there are things we can't do without a verbal history? That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Angel, join into the conversation here.
Well, there's two things that I'm thinking as you're talking. You know, the first thing is, I think that anyone who undertakes to even try this, that's an EMS, I think it's just going to make us better communicators in general. And I think that, you know, with the give and take and you know, forcing you to slow down and listen and look at your person, and I just think it's going to enhance our English-to-English communications to do these kind of tools as well, I think. And that's where I see a value in something like this. And I forgot my other point.
As a regular classroom educator, mm-hmm. what about the scope of practice issue, and that maybe you wouldn't follow a certain drug administration path because you have uncertainty about the patient because you can't communicate with them?
Right.
And what's that?
Well, Rob makes a good point that there are certain life-threatening situations that the logical pathway is you follow it and you give this medication, and there are very few contraindications. So you're going to be fairly safe. But yeah, I think it's very helpful to get as much information as you can. But even in a normal communication situation, you could have people deliberately withholding information or manipulating what they're passing to you. So I just think it's I think there's almost more liability not to make the effort to try to communicate.
Well, chest pain is kind of what's in my mind. You know,
as long as it's only in your mind.
If you have a patient, let's say a Spanish-speaking patient who's clutching their chest, and you say, okay, this patient's having chest pain. Well, is that because he was hit with a baseball bat 30 minutes ago? Is that because he's having a PE? Is that because he's having an anxiety? Exactly, anxiety attack, or is he having cardiac-related chest pain? You put him on an EKG. You see ST elevation. You say, okay, it's cardiac-related chest pain. Now what? Do you give him aspirin? Do you give him morphine? Do you give him nitro? Did he take Viagra yesterday? You know, are we hurting him worse now than if we had just driven as fast as we could with a identified STEMI? These are questions I don't pretend to answer, mm-hmm. but they have arisen in my conversations with people, mm-hmm. and they're saying, okay, well, now what? Now I can sort of kind of bridge this language barrier. Now what do I do with that information?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head earlier. If there are certain elements of the history that you cannot obtain any way, shape, or form, there are certain things that you absolutely cannot do. And sometimes you have to put the interventions in context of how big of an impact would giving those medications be, and right. you know, how big a deal is it to withhold those until they arrive in hospital and there's a translator. You know, in some cases, it's not so much a big issue.
Right. You know, the other thing...
It's complex, though, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. The other thing I was thinking, I thought my other point, having done a little bit of international travel, what I found was that I was in Italy for a short period of time, in Malaysia, teaching EMS both times, and what I found very interesting is if I just made an effort to try to speak the language, although I fumbled it and, you know, I was a source of several jokes, I'm quite sure, and probably said some very inappropriate things when I didn't mean to. But just the fact that I made that effort really helped me connect with people. And I can just imagine as a paramedic trying to treat someone and, you know, they're seeing you struggle through this, but I can imagine that they're going to feel that compassion. They're going to recognize that you're trying to communicate with them. I can't understand why anybody would be opposed to even trying that.
That's an interesting connection to what Mike Touchstone was talking about at the start of this hour, is mm-hmm. that people look for attitude, and, you know, the fact that you were trying, that's an observable behavior. But then people, that leaves a good feeling right. with the patient. And
I think, you know, if you speak to anyone who speaks another language, especially anyone who speaks another language as their first language, they'll tell you that when you live in a country where the dominant language is another language, there's an attitude of entitlement that you will be expected to speak that language. So I think you're bang on that people do really respond to that, the fact that you made an effort, even if your attempts are horrible. They really, really respond to that.
I have an interesting story in that regard. One of the women who's helped us most is a woman named Patricia Rivera, who's a college professor, was a journalist at the Dallas Morning News and the New York Times, a professional English speaker, basically, but she was born in Bolivia. And she is now a professor of Spanish. She was involved in a car accident and struck her head and lost the ability to speak English. She's been here all her life. She moved here as a child. Her native language was Spanish, of course, and she was concussed basically in the language center that held her English, and she lost her ability. She said it was the most terrifying thing she's ever been through, because this was in Delaware, and she's trying to speak to her paramedics, and nothing's coming up but Spanish. I had spoke to someone about that issue, and he was explaining to me that when you learn languages as a child, multiple languages as a child, then you have words from both languages attached to the same object. Orange, for instance, has multiple words attached to that object. When you learn, say, English first, this is orange, and then when you learn Spanish, this object is orange, and the word orange means naranja in Spanish, for example. So you have this different pathway to the language. Every now and again, we'll get the response, you know, tell them to speak English, or that's not our responsibility, or something like that. It's usually, frankly, from higher ups. The people who are down there in the trenches are like, hey, I need this. You know, we understand. My response to that has been, if I get to choose who I treat, you know, I can give you a list of people I would rather not treat, the drunk drivers and the child abusers and stuff. But my job is to treat whichever human being arrives on my ambulance, and no matter what language they speak, and we're doing our best. With that being the attitude of most field providers that I see, I want also to protect them from the liability issues that arise now from trying to bridge a language barrier. My understanding of liability is that it's a difference between what is expected of your profession and what you did. So as the expectations for bridging that language barrier increase, the people who don't attempt the language to bridge that language barrier now potentially in years could be facing liability. And I don't want to create liability through this process.
Right. Well, you know, it's I think of those OnStar commercials where, you know, there's someone over the phone translating in Mandarin to a woman who's giving birth in her car. I love that commercial. Right. And it's remarkable to me that between police, fire, and EMS, we don't have some sort of translation service available to us whereby we could, you know, call on cell phone and set up a three-week call.
We do with AT&T. They have it. But it's a subscription service, and there's hefty dollars attached as far as I understand it.
Because I could see, you know, from a management standpoint, when you introduce the idea of helping EMS providers communicate with someone who speaks a different language, there are costs attached to that. So that would probably be their primary reservation. So I guess the key would be identify how much of an issue is this, you know, in a given area, and what's the most cost-effective way to address it.
The main challenge that EMS has in that regard is our extremely limited time frame, our remoteness, and our emergent nature of every, you know, of many things we do. So the hospitals have this AT&T language line in the UK. They have a national translation service that pipes right in through your radio, so you can just get on dispatch and say, I need a Cyrillic translator or whatever. We have been told by people who have received that translation, patients, that they feel very uncomfortable speaking to a third party that they don't know on a phone somewhere.
Yeah.
That's in the hospital. Now, in a car accident, for example, I mean, we're talking, you know, what we created basically was an idea, a way to bridge the I have 5 seconds to fix something problem. You don't have time to get your personal cell phone out. You don't have time to dial up a radio. You know, this is a right now issue. And one of the reasons we have not tried to create a book that would be used in an ER or a doctor's office is because they have time.
Yeah.
They have resources that we don't have out in the field, and the things that exist now on the market don't address what we need. If there was something out, I wouldn't have written the book. Mm-hmm. So basically what we've done is truncated the language down into the very basic elements of the language to say, are you dying? Are you in immediate life-threatening situation? What do we need to do to fix that?
One of the things I'm thinking about is one of my axioms is you ask a good question, you'll get a good answer. Ask a bad question, you'll get a bad answer. And with that thought in mind, Angel, when you're training students, what are some things that we can do? And that's a big part of the process that Jeff has gone through with Miguel is to identify good questions that we can get students to ask better questions.
Mm-hmm.
How do we teach them?
There's a couple different strategies that you can use, but we do it a couple different ways in the program, actually, through some various exercises. One of the things that we do is we play like a 20 question type of a thing or a 10 question. I've got this thing I'm thinking of, and you need to drill it down, and you need to get to it in 10 questions or less. And through a series of very targeted moves, and you sort of go around the classroom until you name the disease or, you know, you name the problem. That's one thing you can do. Another thing that we actually do in the classroom is we have some scenarios, and as we're doing scenarios, we oftentimes will spend some time with what's the very next question you want to ask.
Right.
And then, you know, would you ask that question? Would you ask something different? Well, what would you ask? What would give you the biggest bang for your buck? What do you really want to know next? Drill it down. We also have some activities that we do in our clinical setting where the students go in, and the instructions in this particular setting is they might not, you know, they don't think of interviewing as clinical, but we send them to a simulated patient lab setting where they're videotaped, and all they do is an interview. That's all they do. They're not doing anything clinical, and we videotape it and we watch it in class.
Right.
And then we debrief about, you know, what did you think about this? And Would, if you had it to do over again, would you ask different questions? And so we really do try to work on that communication piece because it's so important. Because, it, again, if you ask the right questions, you get the good answers, and you're very good with your time management because of that.
Excellent. Yeah, we're reaching the wrap-up point of our show. I think quite well we've done. Go ahead, Rob.
I just wanted to get Angel's thoughts on our discussion with Mike earlier. Did you have any thoughts while you were listening to us? Any comments about what we talked about?
Well, I was sort of in and out for what I could hear, and was able to focus on.
In and out, she means like socializing with other people, and not like in and out of consciousness.
Right. Exactly. I'm still fuzzy because I had to give a final this morning, so I'm still kind of fuzzy from that as well. But I have been following a lot of stuff Mike has been doing, and following the columns that he's been writing, and a lot of the affective things that he's been focusing on, and I think he's on target with a lot of the things that he's doing. And you know, I've heard people say a lot of times that you can kind of train a monkey to sometimes do some of the things we do, but you know, can you train them to do it right and with the right attitude?
Right.
And I think attitude really is everything. I mean, we can give people a lot of these psychomotor skills, but and I just remember going to do an instructor course years ago out in Illinois, where we had this really rich discussion where we were talking about attitude with these educators. And this one gentleman in the audience was adamant about he didn't care at all how anybody was being treated, as long as they, or how anybody was being treated, you know, in the questioning and the answering and the affect, as long as they had good clinical skills. And it was really interesting to see. I just sort of stepped back and let the participants guide their own discussion on this. And he really got hammered. And by the end of it, he was recognizing that, you know, you can do some pretty stupid things clinically, but it's that attitude that helps fix it, helps smooth it over and all that.
And Hollywood doesn't help at all. You know, television shows, you know, like House and other shows that depict medical professionals as incredibly arrogant, nasty, rude, socially dysfunctional, but brilliantly competent as clinicians. And so it can't help but influence other people in that effect. Now, I have another sort of comment and question.
We're getting our final thoughts, so okay. We're running out of time.
I have a comment. Teaching in the affective domain, without question, is the most challenging part of any educator. And, you know, in our program, we try to model what we think are the right behaviors, the right attitudes, and we treat our students very much like colleagues. And we've sort of implemented some rules in the classroom and in the labs that hopefully will prepare students for the environment they're going into. Things as simple as they must wear a uniform when they come to lab. They must show up in time. They must be, for men, they must be clean shaven. The shirt must be buttoned up a certain way. The boots must be shiny. And when they work in the lab, they treat it like a station. They clean
right.
it. They restock. They put things away, organize things. Angels, are there other things do you think educators can be doing apart from those small things to help students develop the attitudes necessary to be compassionate and empathetic and not let the not-so-nice patients get under their skin?
In 5 minutes or less.
Sure.
The fast version.
Yeah, I think you have to be really deliberate with your strategies. It has to become a component of what you're grading and scoring. You know, if you're going to truly have value on it, then you probably need to have a grade attached to it in some form or fashion. And the students have to see that. And I think you also, you know, we all have our on days and our off days. And when you have that off day and you recognize it, I think it's important to stand in front of the students and say, you know, I was a little off color today, or I was, you know, I kind of picked on this student a little bit, and I'm sorry. And just own it, and you know, because we're not perfect people that are trying to teach these other people, but we're trying to demand that they be perfect.
Right.
Well, you have to set a good example, but you also have to recognize you're human. You've got to lay the foundation, and you just have to own it. But you do find we have ways of grading it, and you do have to find ways of grading it.
And I think we've got a future topic to really dig into this affective domain piece and how you score it. Angel, if listeners want to get a hold of you, how can they connect with you?
Best way to get a hold of me is through the college. It's aburba, A-B-U-R-B-A, at howardcc.edu. I'm on Facebook. Just search my name, and I also have Twitter.
And you speak quite a bit at conferences as well, so people can see you out and about. And, Jeff, where can people find both information on the product and connect with you?
The website is emspanol.com, E-M-S-P-A-N-O-L.com. And my email is jeff@emergencylanguage.com.
Outstanding.
I just want to say thanks to Angel and Jeff for joining us. And, Jeff, you know, your passion and your interest in being able to communicate with the Spanish community says to me that you're a paramedic who is a patient advocate first, who looks, you know, at what's important for the patient, not what's important for you, and it ties in perfectly with the affective domain, and I think the work you're doing is brilliant, and congratulations on the book.
I appreciate you saying that.
Thanks so much for joining us. People can get a hold of me on my blog at paramedictutor.wordpress.com, and there's a billion multimedia presentations there that educators are welcome to use with their students on everything from ECG interpretation to oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve.
Lots of stuff
good
there.
Stuff.
And I'm Greg Fries, at G Fries on Twitter, emseducast.com. Of course, you can connect with us, facebook.com/emseducast. And I just want to close with something that I say a lot is that EMS is a really wide field, and there's lots of opportunities for any of us to specialize in a narrow point and become an expert in that area, just as Jeff has demonstrated and Mike earlier with his focus on discipline and training. So there's lots of opportunities, listeners, for you to become an expert somewhere. I want to conclude by thanking GEMS and EMS Today for having us broadcasting live, the ProMed Network booth sponsored by Zoll. We're real happy to be here. We'll be doing another live show tomorrow with a great group of guests, and you can find us anytime at emseducast.com.